things that must be involved with our singing, and that's the mind and the spirit. 1 Corinthians 14 and verse 15 says, "What is the outcome then? I will pray with the spirit, and I will pray with the mind also. I will sing with the spirit, and I will sing with the mind also." And so there is an intellectual aspect to our singing in some of these hymns, in all of these hymns. And then there is a spiritual component. There is a liveliness that is given into our singing. And I think sometimes, if I speak from personal experience, it becomes almost rote because we become so familiar with the songs. You know, we don't even have to look at the PowerPoint slides. We don't have to look at the book. It just kind of spills out of us because we're so familiar with it. But the truth of the scriptures is that actually we are teaching one another as we sing. And imagine a teacher who doesn't spend a lot of time in preparation for their lessons. You think you can tell when somebody doesn't spend as much time in preparation? I think so. It becomes pretty obvious. What about our singing, though? Do we prepare ourselves? Are our minds and our hearts engaged? We sing a song fairly often called "The Lord Has Been Mindful of Me." And you notice that pronoun there, me. There are a lot of things in life that challenge us and challenge who we are and our perspective on the world. And sometimes, again, I think we fall into this habit, if I speak again in generalism, we fall into this habit of singing these songs and not really recognizing what we're singing. What we're singing when we think about this song and as we teach with this song, "The Lord has been mindful of me." I mean, that's a positive idea. God has been involved in my life. It's a powerful statement. It's been said that it's three times easier to remember something negative than to remember something positive. I think we'd all agree that that's true. For every one good thing that we remember, we probably remember three bad things that have happened in our lives. And so we need to have these reminders to remember God's provision, especially as we reflect upon those instances in our lives that we might classify as afflictions, as challenges, as distressing features in our lives. You think about providence and you think about the idea of provision, the fact that God has the world in his hands and that he is invested and involved in this world. That is one thing that separates Christianity from deism. Deism is the belief that God created a world and then kind of hands-off approach. Christianity tells us that God is involved in the world, that he is involved in the affairs of nations, that he is involved in the affairs of individuals. He does care. He is involved. He's invested in this world. He cares about this world. Christianity tells us that he cares so much that he puts himself into this world in an impossible fashion, in a miraculous and supernatural fashion. That's how much he cares about this world. That's how much he cares about you. To step into this world to change your lot in this life. I've shared in the past two lessons what I hope to be personal illustrations that impact you, that make a connection. And I wanted to share these things because we're people. We're real. And I think sometimes preachers have kind of this formality, this grave informality in their approach. I should involve myself. I should use general illustrations. I think we should use personal illustrations. I think we should use illustrations that say that God has been mindful, in fact, of all of us, including the speaker. God has been mindful of me. And I want to share another thought with you this morning as we begin our lesson. The past two nights, I talked a lot about my parents, or yesterday morning and the night before. I talked a lot about my parents, and it's a mixed bag. I think I'll present a lot of negative ideas, but at the end of our series, and Give Me a Burning Heart, I hope to share with you a very positive memory that I have with my parents, and hopefully that will be helpful for us. But I did have a lot of very negative experiences. Both my parents tried to commit suicide. I've been involved in separating them, pulling them apart. I've been thrown across a room by my dad. I mean, there's just been all kinds of ugliness. And especially when I was a teenager, this was very difficult. I had a very tough home life when I was a teenager. And I think when you're a teenager and you go to public school, it's inevitable when you have a tough home life that you spend time in the guidance department. You spend a lot of time with the guidance counselors. And my guidance counselor was named Judy Clark, and she's actually from Bowling Green, Kentucky. She's a Kentucky native. And her mediation in my life provided me with great, immense resources to actually become a Christian. It was through her influence that I was pointed in the right direction. It was through her influence that helped me to become a Christian, a man, and a victor. Things weren't great at home. And at various periods, local authorities had to get involved. And we used an illustration of that yesterday, Christmas night, when I was about 15 years old. My parents were just trying to tear each other apart, and the police were there, and it was just a horrible, horrible circumstance. When they got involved, I was typically encouraged to go see my guidance counselor. And those times that I got to spend with my guidance counselor really helped me work through those issues and helped me to become a Christian. And I can tell you, honestly, that I was an immature teenage boy. I was struggling to understand my place in the world. I was struggling with understanding the role that I was to serve in. And she suggested that I kind of get things together. I had been doing all right academically. I had been doing right being involved in school and whatnot. I've been doing well in those things because my parents really pushed for that. But she wanted me to really kind of put things together. And so she pushed me to make a decision about going to college. I had a full ride anywhere in Florida and hadn't done anything about it. Typical teenage guy, delaying, procrastinating, and I had not done anything about it. April of my senior year, she approached me and said, think about college, because I wanted to go to college, but I hadn't done anything to prepare for it. She got me to think about that, and at her instigation, I visited and enrolled in a college that prepared me to be a better man. It was a great school, and while attending that school, I actually became a Christian because of the influence of the people that I was around. I was baptized for the forgiveness of my sins, all because of my guidance counselor directing me in that direction. You know, it's hard, though, because when we think about the ugliness, when we think about the darkness in our lives, it's very hard to see the light that traces through that darkness. And think about all the ugly things that have happened in my teenage years especially. And I see that light tracing through there now because I have that perspective. It's not easy to see that when you're going through those things. But I see the light that was tracing through all of that. Mrs. Clark, Mrs. Judy Clark helped me. And I honestly and wholeheartedly believe that God used those circumstances, those ugly circumstances in my life, to bring me into contact and relationship with Judy Clark, and most importantly, to bring me in a relationship with Christ. I believe in providence. I think sometimes we become too reserved in thinking about providence. The scriptures tell us, though, that every good and perfect gift comes from God. And so anything good that happens in your life, guess where that comes from? That comes from God. And so I think we need to develop our understanding of providence and how God is involved in our lives and remembering God's provision throughout our lives. You know, verse 1 of this song, "The Lord has been mindful of me," it says, "Though I through the valley of shadow or mountain or troubled sea and oft in the darkness have traveled, the Lord has been mindful of me." And this writer of this hymn, he's not just saying, overlook all the ugliness in your life. It would be foolish to do that. It would be futile to do that. He's saying, have perspective. See in those ugly moments that the Lord has been mindful of you. And of course, this is, you know, founded upon that promise in Psalm 23, that as we walk in the valley of the shadow of death, you will fear no evil. Well, why? Because God is there. His rod and his staff, they comfort me. They provide for me. And so what we want to do, this kind of runs in conjunction with yesterday's lesson. What we want to do today, as we begin in our first point in thinking about biblical examples of God's mindfulness, is to establish from a biblical perspective that God is mindful of his people. And he's demonstrated that throughout the annals of history. He's been involved. And of course, the classic example would be Abraham. Abraham, really about half of Genesis is devoted to him. Many passages in the New Testament devoted to him. Hebrews 11, even Romans bringing up Abraham's example. Abraham was God's patriarch. He chose a man, he brought him out of Ur of the Chaldees and created a full nation from him, from whom Jesus would descend. And you think about God's providence in his life, and we won't read through these passages, but you know, you could read through Genesis 11 through about 30 or so, and really through the end of the book, thinking about his immediate descendants. He takes Abraham and he extracts him from a pagan culture. If you look at the names of Abraham's family, that tells us a lot about where he came from. They were named after pagan gods. Even Sarai was named after a pagan god. He takes him and he extracts him out of a pagan culture. He brings him out of that so he can influence him towards good. He guards his travels. And you think about all the traveling that Abraham does back and forth, even during the famines when he goes down to Egypt and he comes back to Canaan, or the Chaldees to Canaan in the first place. All these travels that he's doing, he has God's protection. God is with him. He provided a family and a nation for him. Even when he was too old to have a family, he made him a father. One of the first fathers. He provided that family, provided that nation, and he protected that family. Through all of the dumb things that Abraham did, through all of the dumb things that Isaac did, through all of the opportunities where God's plan could have been foiled by humankind, God finds a way and he allows his plan to come to fruition. He protects them. He cares enough to make Abraham a home teeming with the finest. After all, Canaan becomes a land of milk and honey, doesn't it? And who's there before that? Abraham, cultivating the land as a sojourner. One of Abraham's descendants is Joseph. Joseph is a strong point of emphasis in the book of Genesis. Isaac and Jacob, they get some attention, but really it's all about Abraham and Joseph in a sense, isn't it? Think about the last 12, 13 chapters of Genesis, and they're all about Joseph. Joseph was God's dreamer. When you think about Joseph's life, you see that God is mindful of his losses. Joseph loses his mother when she gives birth to his brother, Benjamin. And God takes care of him. Not just in that loss, but in all losses. God unlocked Joseph's potential. He's just a kid with a colorful coat given by his dad. His daddy's favorite. God unlocks that potential. And how does he do that? Through a furnace, doesn't he? God recognized Joseph's brother's resentment. He acknowledged it and he used it to put Joseph in a situation of blessing. God used Joseph's abilities and gave him opportunities to exercise those. Joseph was a good steward of resources. Well, how do you demonstrate your good stewardship? You have to be a steward over resources. Well, how do you become a steward over resources? Somebody has to appoint you as a steward over resources. Of course, that all happens in Potiphar's household, doesn't it? And then ultimately, with Pharaoh. God was mindful of the totality of Joseph's misfortunes. And I would tell you that he's mindful of every misfortune that's taking place in your life. There's nothing that he oversees. There's nothing that he's absent for. He's using those things to make you, not break you. Of course, Moses would be a tremendous example as well. Moses, the pen of Genesis through Deuteronomy, the penman, he is very much involved. He's a classic example of faithfulness, imperfect faithfulness, but faithfulness nonetheless. Keystone, the Old Testament and the New Testament. There's so much in his life that demonstrates God's mindfulness and God's faithfulness that it's hard to focus on any specific areas, isn't it? Because you don't want to exclude anything else. So let's think about three stages in Moses' life. After all, that's typically how we study Moses' life. First 40 years, second 40 years, third 40 years. In stage one, he's a baby in a basket, condemned for death. He's saved. And not only is he saved from death, he's given a prominent upbringing. In fact, Stephen even mentions in his sermon before he is martyred that Moses was skilled. He was skilled and he was educated. He was a leader raised in Pharaoh's household. He's given prestige. He's given prominent upbringing. He becomes a leader of his people. You know, even in Moses' flight after the Egyptian's death, God takes care of him. He kills an Egyptian. What do you think that would have done with the Egyptians? They would have been chasing after him, one of the greatest empires in all of history, held at bay so Moses could make it into the wilderness. And then during this stage two event, when he's out in the wilderness and he's being cultivated and he's being kind of groomed into God's leader, he's a man in the desert. He learns to be a shepherd. And God's mindfulness gave opportunities for him to lead and be led. Throughout his life, we see him being trained and groomed as God's prophet, as God's leader. And then our third stage, when he returns from this fresh and complete armament of God out near Mount Sinai, actually, Moses is able to speak boldly before Pharaoh. He pronounces the 10 plagues. He leads those impetuous and complacent Israelites to where they need to be, through the barren wilderness to the borders of Canaan. And during this trip, during this first couple of years in the wilderness, God descends on Mount Sinai in a most miraculous way. Exodus 19 tells us about that. He descends into our realm, and he ratifies this nation, this people, and he speaks to Moses face to face. He trains him. He gives him the law. And as we think about Exodus, you ever made this connection? He spends 40 days and 40 nights on the mountain, not once, but twice. In Exodus 24 and verse 18, when they first receive this covenant, when they first receive these Ten Commandments, Exodus 24 and verse 18 tells us for the first time that Moses spends 40 days and 40 nights on Mount Sinai. Then you keep turning the pages. And then in Exodus 32, they build a golden calf. And he comes down from the mountain and he smashes the tablets. And he goes right back up to the top of Mount Sinai. And what happens once more? He spends another 40 days and 40 nights fasting and being with God. Everything that Moses went through trained and prepared him to fill his allotted charge from God. He became a leader, he became a shepherd, he even became a warrior. Because God provided the resources necessary to make him an exceptional individual, a man of God, as the scriptures tell us. You think it was easy for Moses? I don't know how much time he spent in the desert, but I imagine that probably wasn't very easy, was it? To have your own household turn against you. To be fleeing for your life. All these events that Moses went through, certainly he probably lacked perspective. He said, why does this keep happening to me? Where is God? Why are we servants to a nation that bowed down to us 400 years ago? Why? Why? And yet he persevered. Israel is another example. And Deuteronomy 8, particularly verses 3 and 4, and then we can have a couple of cross-references for that. But Deuteronomy 8 shares with us vivid details that help us understand the intervention of God on behalf of his people. The passage tells us that manna was provided for food for 40 years. You know, an interesting note about that manna as well, not only did they have to collect it, but they had to do something with it. If you look at Exodus or Deuteronomy, there are several times in that section that tell us that they had to pound it and make bread out of it. They had to do something with it. They had to cultivate what God had given to them and use it to his benefit. Water was provided for their thirst. Of course, that's one of the disasters in Moses' life. He's told to speak to the rock and he smites the rock with his staff. Deuteronomy 8 also tells us that their sandals did not wear out for 40 years of travel. I pretty much have to get new shoes once a year. And I go pretty much to the edge of the cliff with my shoes. They become so nasty and so defiled. 40 years in a desert. You know what else? Deuteronomy 8 tells us that their feet didn't even swell. Their feet didn't even swell. Deuteronomy also tells us that God set his people as a beacon unto the nations. And in all these blessings, God was not merely providing for physical necessity, but he was actually reinforcing their spiritual armament and their maturation. If you turn to Hosea with me, there's a beautiful passage in Hosea. Of course, Hosea is given the charge of marrying a harlot and basically dealing with what God deals with Israel for his life. And in Hosea chapter 2 and verse 14, there's a beautiful statement about God's relationship with Israel. It's almost like a proposal, an engagement. Hosea 2 and verse 14 says, "Therefore, behold, I will allure her, bring her into the wilderness, and speak kindly to her." He's using the example of what happened previous in Israelites' history. He says, before, we were in the wilderness and we were connected. I was providing for you day in and day out in such a beautiful way. I was providing manna. I was providing water out of the rock. He's calling them back to that relationship, demonstrating this intimate relationship as a betrothal, an engagement, even a honeymoon period, if you want to think about that idea. Even in all of those reminders of God's mindfulness, even though God had established a husband and wife relationship with them, guess what Israel did? Israel's comfort bred discontentment. The question, of course, is, will we learn? After all, we are called the spiritual Israel, and all too often we find ourselves in the same position of Israel, don't we? Romans 15, verse 4, and 1 Corinthians 10, verse 6 tell us to learn from Israel's mistakes. To be faithful, to understand that we have a spiritual rock, which is Christ. To understand that we are not immersed in a body of water, but we are immersed into Christ. That we have a tremendous example and relationship that has been cultivated. One more biblical example, and that's David. David was God's king. So we have God's patriarch. We have God's dreamer. We have God's bride in Israel. We have God's leader in Moses, and we have God's king. I mean, all throughout the book of the Bible, you see these classic examples of faithfulness where God has been mindful of his people, that God's providence has been active, it has been alive in this world. And that's no different. God still cares about us. As David reflected on his life, he expressed confidence in the Lord's presence. Go ahead and turn to Psalm 23. After all, verse 1 of our song focuses on that very idea. Though I walk through the valley of shadows. Psalm 23, we'll read the whole psalm. It's very short. It's only 6 verses. Psalm 23 and verse 1, you could probably quote it. "The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. He makes me lie down in green pastures. He leads me beside still, quiet waters. He restores my soul. He guides me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I fear no evil, for you are with me. Your rod and your staff, they comfort me. You prepare a table before me in the presence of my enemies. You have anointed my head with oil. My cup overflows. Surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever." It's amazing, this short little collection of verses. He says, I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And then he says, surely goodness and loving kindness will follow me all the days of my life. You see that contrast? You see that oxymoron of thought? You know, it's interesting when you compare this with the previous psalm, and the book of Psalms is structured. Psalm 22 and verse 1. We know it. God said it on the cross. my God, why have you forsaken me? There are times in our lives where we feel like God isn't there. We feel like God has left us, if we're honest. The scriptures are very clear to tell us that God has not left us, that he has paid attention to us. Look at Psalm 22 and verse 24. The same one that wrote, my God, why have you forsaken me? Psalm 22 and verse 24, for he has not despised nor abhorred the affliction of the afflicted, nor has he hidden his face from him. But when he cried to him for help, he heard. He's been there. He's watching over your life. He's a guardian over your life. He's been involved. As we think about this shepherd psalm, it's all the more poignant when you think about who David is. A shepherd. It's a perfect illustration. And you think about that not only in David's life, but also in the descendants of David's. You study through, you know, 1 Kings, where the transition happens between David and Solomon, and it goes all the way down the line from Rehoboam all the way down the line to the Babylonian captivity. And what do you see over and over again? He was like my servant David. I have blessed them because of my servant David. Over and over and over again. Some of David's most important descendants demonstrate faithfulness, don't they? You remember Hezekiah? Hezekiah, he doesn't even reach middle age and God says, you're going to die. 39 years old, you're going to die. You remember what Hezekiah says? He takes confidence in the Lord's presence. Turn to Isaiah chapter 38. Isaiah 38 and verse 3. Hezekiah says, remember now, O Lord, I beseech you, how I have walked before you in truth and with a whole heart, and have done what is good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. He says, I've walked in a relationship with you. You've taken care of me in the past. Take care of me now. And what, of course, happens is Hezekiah is given an extended portion of life. We can honestly and literally say that he was walking through the valley of the shadow of death. Yet he prevailed, and the sun shone once more on his face. Well, if you can believe that, that's only verse 1 of The Lord Has Been Mindful of Me. And we could keep going extensively, but we'll go a little bit briefer in the next two verses. Verse 2 tells us, much more than my grief and my sorrow, much more than adversity, much more than the all I have been given, the Lord has been mindful of me. God is mindful in our afflictions. In Genesis chapter 16 and verse 13, Hagar, who had been rejected, spurned from God's people, God speaks to her. He comforts her. You remember what she says? She calls God El Roy. And thankfully, the scriptures translate that for us, and it says, he is the God who sees. Is that how you reflect upon who God is? Is that how you think about God's provision? He is the Lord who sees? Or are we lost in that valley of darkness and we think God does not see us? We think we have been forsaken. We think we have been despised, perhaps rejected. You know, it's not enough to consider circumstances outside of ourselves. I think it's helpful as we think about biblical examples. But this song says the Lord has been mindful of who? Me. Yes, he's been mindful of David. Yes, he's been mindful of Moses. Yes, he's been mindful of all these different people. But as we sing this song, we're not singing about that, are we? We're singing, the Lord has been mindful of me. It has to become personal. It has to become actualized. We have to take it a step further. We have to consider that God is present in our afflictions. In Psalm 68, Psalm 68 and verse 19. I love this. It's one of those places where you see the Selah pause too. Think about this. Meditate on this. Psalm 68 and verse 19. Blessed be the Lord who daily bears our burden. The God who is our salvation. He daily bears our burden. You know, we're commanded as Christians to bear one another's burdens. You know what's amazing about all of that? It's like we're all standing on God's shoulders. He's bearing all of our burdens for us. It's a beautiful, beautiful illustration. In Psalm 107, we build on this idea, and we see this idea almost like a sailor on the storms of life, sailing on the uncertain seas of life. In Psalm 107, in verses 23 through 32, we read this. Those who go down to the sea in ships, who do business on great waters, they have seen the works of the Lord, and He wonders in the deep. And His wonders in the deep. For He spoke and raised up a stormy wind, which lifted up the waves of the sea. They rose up to the heavens. They went down to the depths. Their soul melted away, and their misery they reeled and staggered like a drunken man, and were at their wits' end. Then they cried to the Lord in their trouble, and He brought them out of their distresses. He caused the storm to be still, so that the waves of the sea were hushed. Then they were glad because they were quiet. So He guided them to their desired haven. Let them give thanks to the Lord for His loving kindness and for His wonders to the sons of men. Let them extol Him also in the congregation of the people and praise Him at the seat of the elders. You don't have to be a mariner to understand the image. You're out in the seas, you're skilled, and yet all those skills are nothing because the storms have found you. You're at your wit's end in life. And you reach out to God, and God delivers you. It's a beautiful, beautiful illustration. Times in which we traveled in the darkness, which represent, of course, the sinfulness of the world. This world is in and robed in darkness. God is mindful of us through it all. Thinking back to all the promises that God has given to us, some of those we examined yesterday. Consider all the events in which God has confirmed and validated His presence in your life. You know, I think this is a really interesting exercise. I saw it one time when I was studying. And it had to do with this idea of putting a check next to every promise that God has fulfilled. Guess what? Your Bible is going to be full of check marks. God keeps His promises. Do that sometime. If you're okay with having 10 million check marks in your Bible, do it. It's an immensely profitable exercise. You know, to each of us, a share of sorrow and grief is given. A share of sorrow and grief is given. 1 Thessalonians 4, verse 13 talks about that there is a weeping that is done in this world, a weeping, a grief because of death. 1 Peter 2, very similar idea of suffering. A share of sorrow and grief is given to us all. But rather than throw our confidence away, we should gain confidence in our own reflections and meditation upon His presence. In Hebrews chapter 10, in verses 32 through 39, we have a tremendous set of promises given to us and fulfillments. In Hebrews chapter 10, in verses 32 through 39, "But remember the former days when after being enlightened you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners and accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward, for you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what has been promised. For yet in a little while, in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no delight in him. But we are not of those who shrink back to destruction, but of those who have faith to the persevering of the soul." You know, Winston Churchill was asked to speak one time at a commencement. It was after World War II. He hadn't really spoken in a forum like that for a long time. He'd been tired and really ravaged from the war. And this group of people at this commencement, they were wondering what he was going to say. They were wondering what sight of wisdom he would provide for them, what empowering rhetoric he would provide for them. You know what he said? He went up to the microphone. He said this. He said, "Never give up. Never give up. Never give up." And he went and he sat down. It's one of the most impactful speeches of all time. 9 words. We need that. Satan is a roaring lion seeking to devour us. He wants us to shrink back to destruction, but God says, "No, that's not you. we are higher than that. We are nobler than that. We have a better example than that. Don't believe the foolishness that God isn't involved in your lives. And honestly, if we are going to seek and serve Christ, there are things that we're going to have to give up. There are sacrifices that are made. We have to pick up a cross, not sit down in a lazy boy. The call of Christ is of sacrifice. God, though, is mindful in all these things, just as he was with Hagar here. He was mindful of the sacrifices that she made. He was mindful of Hagar. He's mindful of you. He is the God who sees. I want to share three short sayings with you, three short pithy sayings, and hopefully these will be impactful. I found them to be very impactful. First of all, it is often in our darkest hour that the light of God's presence shines the brightest. Secondly, stars cannot shine without darkness. And third, shadows always have a light on the other side of their object. You think about that. In order for a shadow to be cast, there has to be light. There's always light in the shadows. Verse 3, very quickly, God is mindful, not just in our afflictions, but in our blessings. I'm rich, I am saved, I am happy, I'm health and prosperity. I have friends, I have doors ever open. God has been mindful of me. To reflect upon God's presence exclusively in our darkest hours is to do Him a tremendous disservice. Thanksgiving and gratitude of the noblest sort are gained in recognizing the Lord as the source of all blessings. He is the Father of lights. No variation or shifting shadow. He gives us every good and perfect gift, James tells us. And if we truly believe the thought reflected in that verse, then we'll view all good things through that lens of thankfulness. Whether it be a job promotion or a family relationship, a transfer, a move, a child, a grandchild, any sort of life happenstance, any sort of beneficial blessing is from God, and we should give Him thanks for His mindfulness. It's very easy to point the finger in our distresses, but how often do we bow down in our blessings? He's a source of all good things. He's a source of salvation. That's the most significant blessing that any of us can afford. Ephesians chapter 1 and verse 3 tells us that we have every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. That's a beautiful idea. That can just be extrapolated to the ends of the earth. What are those spiritual blessings? Well, atonement, propitiation, forgiveness, mercy, enablement, empowerment, so on and so forth, all the way down the list. By grace we have been saved through faith. And that's why Paul tells us in Philippians 4 and verse 4, the one who suffered, the one who was persecuted, the one who was stoned and left for dead, he says, rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Beautiful illustration for us. In addition, we have whatever degree of prosperity God has given to us, whatever degree of health God has given to us, whatever He has seen that we need. But seek first His kingdom and His righteousness, and all these things will be gathered unto you. He is the ultimate Father. Furthermore, for those of us who have struggled with family issues, which probably is, I would think, a lot of us, for all of us who have struggled with family issues, we have friends in the Lord who will be like fathers, mothers, sisters, and brothers to us. That's the illustration that Jesus used. For he who sacrifices, he gains tenfold, a hundredfold. Truly, each child of God can say that the Lord has been mindful of him. Or her. God is mindful of all of us. We need to be like Abraham, thinking about another name that's been given to God. In Genesis 22, when Abraham bows down to offer his son, the ultimate sacrifice, he calls God Jehovah Jireh. You know what that means? The Lord will provide. He's the God who sees, and He's the Lord who provides. You know, in this life, we will have times of toil, tribulation, even tragedy, but we will also have times of triumph and blessing. And through it all, the many good things that we have from the Lord's bountiful hand to supply our needs and sustain us reminds us that the Lord has been mindful of me. C.S. Lewis said it costs nothing, as far as we know, to create nice things by God. But to convert rebellious wills cost his crucifixion. Romans chapter 8 and verse 37, I'll leave you with that thought. Romans 8 verse 37 says that we are more than conquerors. You know, the word that's used there is hypernikao. Hypernikao in Greek. You know what that means? Hyper victors. Super victors. We are super victors in God. I'll leave you with that thought as we close this morning.